This is How Success Happens, where we talk to polar explorers, war correspondents, founders, ultramarathoners, authors, artists, and a range of other unique personalities to help you understand the capabilities behind how success happens.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
You sold something like 250,000 books.
I'm the managing editor at entrepreneur.com and your host, Linda Lacina. Today, we talk to Christopher Kimball. He's advised home cooks for more than 25 years as a publisher, editor, and a host on TV and radio for brands he founded, such as Cooks Illustrated and America's Test Kitchen. He recently launched a new media venture called Milk Street, which explores modern cooking as a mashup of global flavors and techniques. We'll talk to him about building this latest brand, as well as how his eclectic background, one that includes a degree in primitive art and an early job as a New York cabbie, fits in. He'll explain how those experiences shaped him and what we can all learn.
But first, a word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Dan Bova, editorial director of entrepreneur.com. Here's a crazy statistic. More than one quarter of all Americans say they'd start their own business in the next year if they could, but only a fraction of those actually do it. Why? Well, because taking that leap can be scary. So luckily, there's Weebly. Weebly is the easiest way to create an incredible looking website. But more importantly, it comes with a whole bunch of tools to help you sell your products, process payment, manage inventory, create marketing campaigns, and grow your brand. And because Weebly's mission is to help turn people's great ideas into successful businesses, they've built an incredible support team. If you have a question, just pick up the phone to talk to a customer success expert. No scripts, no robots, just a friendly human who can help you do what needs doing. So if you've got a product or idea you want to share with the world, check out Weebly. You can have a beautiful, powerful online store up and running in a matter of hours. And because you listen to this podcast, you can visit weebly.com/HSH and get 15% off your first purchase. Don't just build a beautiful website, build a successful online business with Weebly.
How are you, Chris?
I'm great. How are you?
Very good. Very good. So can you level set for all of us? Can you talk to us a little bit about Milk Street and what makes something a Milk Street recipe or a Milk Street story and topic? What boxes does it need to check?
Well, the premise of Milk Street is that American cooking traditionally is based on Northern European cooking, most of it. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's a very small subset of all the possible ways to think about cooking in terms of the actual food, the preparation of the food, the social surround, even the philosophy of cooking. So if you travel around the world now and see how people cook every day, I'm not talking about fancy cookbooks and, you know, company food, that kind of thing, how people really cook, you find that there are a lot of ways to cook that are not being used here, but more importantly, actually are a lot better. Mm-hmm. And in a nutshell, if you start with big flavors, then you don't have to do a lot to end up with big flavors. And most places in the world start with big flavors. Northern Europe didn't. They started with fairly bland flavors and used a lot of technique, time, and heat to get to flavor at the end. But the rest of the world doesn't do that. They start with big flavors, and then they get to big flavors fairly easily. Handfuls of herbs, chilies, spices, fermented sauces, etc. So there's a whole world of cooking out there that's simpler and bolder. That's mm-hmm. the concept.
Yes, that's, and you travel. You've always traveled, but you are traveling a lot for this as well. And you just got back from Japan and Taipei. What mm-hmm. are those visits like? What are you looking for? What are you hoping to find?
Well, there are two answers to that. For the recipes themselves, I'm looking for something that I can adapt to the United States. We're not interested or not able to take an authentic recipe and then authentically ship it over here, right?
Yeah.
I was cooking with some people in Tokyo and then in Taipei, and a beef noodle soup, for example, is a very famous Taiwanese recipe. Well, they start with a big, you know, piece of beef bone, you know, and like 20 ingredients, and they do a lot of things. Well, that recipe needs to be vastly streamlined for this group here, our home cooks. So that's the first thing. Which of these things can I take the inspiration from and then come back and work on here? Because most things in any culture probably don't ship very well, you know, don't move around the world. For television, however, because I have a film crew with me, what I really want to do, and I figured this out slowly, is I want to stand next to someone who doesn't speak my language and vice versa and cook with them. Mm-hmm. I was cooking with an 80-year-old making scallion pancakes, this little tiny storefront in the back alley in Taipei, and she lives above the store, and they've been doing it with her mother for 33 years. Well, you know, she's showing me how to do it, and she's talking. She's actually Chinese. And then she got mad at me and took my rolling pin away and started telling me I was doing it all wrong. And then I finally did something right, and she said, okay, you know. And so it's that interaction with someone. And I think the point of that is that you can meet anybody in the world anywhere, and if you cook with them, you have something in common. And that's what the show is about on some level, and what the brand's about is that connection with people anywhere in the world about cooking. And even if you don't speak the same language, there, you know, you can sort of understand each other and have a relationship. And that's what I'm looking for television.
And why is that so important? Why does that interest you?
I've always felt cooking is vastly more important than the food it produces.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's time well spent. I think it's important to lead a full life and an interesting life to cook. I think it's a way of meeting other people. And I mean, you don't cook for yourself, you know, you cook for other people.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much part of the social fabric everywhere in the world, less so in America probably, but it's about community. And I think the notion that you can travel the world as a cook and share something with anybody, it's my, you know, I grew up in the 60s and, you know, an old deadhead hippie and everything. I mean, I still sort of am a true believer, I guess, on some level. And cooking is the pathway, it's sort of the medium by which that happens, that the world is a little smaller. It's very interesting, but you can go anywhere and find people who think like you do because everyone wants to cook. Mm-hmm. So I find that to be a very appealing part of cooking.
And you also sort of mentioned that it changes how you cook. How so? Like, why is it so important to, why is that process so important to informing the way that someone cooks?
Take chicken soup. You know, if you make an American chicken soup, it's okay, but the carrots taste like chicken and the celery and the noodles and the chicken and the broth. It's very much a melting pot recipe, as are most American recipes. If you make a chicken soup, and every culture has chicken soup, you find that other cultures build layers of flavor into it. In Somalia, they'll have a couple of chili-based sauces, and they'll put raw vegetables like radishes or cabbage on top, and they'll put some broken rice into it. So you get heat, you know, you get crunch, you know, you get all these things going on. And so you start to realize that cooking isn't about simmering ingredients down to a common flavor. It's about starting with a lot of diverse tastes and textures and maintaining them. So you're trying to keep their individual tastes. So that totally changes the way you think about cooking.
Mm-hmm.
You're not trying to combine so much and meld as you are to keep distinct flavors and textures alive. So when you put something in your mouth, there's a lot of stuff going on. Mm-hmm. You know, I just had a shrimp dish 2 minutes ago before we started talking from Singapore, and it, you know, it's got shrimp and it's got some tofu, but it's got like lime juice and it's got some heat to it. It must have 8 or 9 things going on.
Mm-hmm.
And you just go, wow, man, that's a totally different way of thinking about food. It's not about the cooking. It's really about the ingredients and how you combine them. You know, just for example, the Ottoman Empire had 88 spices, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Northern Europe had what, 7, 10, you know, of which they used 3 or 4. You know, most of the time. I mean, French cooking, pick up mastering their French cooking and look at how many spices there are.
Yeah.
Almost none, really. Right. They don't use spices. So that's the concept. It's, boy, you know, there's black pepper, but there's all sorts of other kinds of peppers. And each of them has Sichuan peppercorns, so there's white peppers, earth pepper, et cetera, Aleppo. well, they're all different and they all have wonderful flavors. And there's a world out there. And so you think about flavors. You don't just think about boiling versus steaming versus roasting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that there's a connection for me between all of those ideas that, you know, you can't be an interesting cook unless you, you know, sort of lead an interesting life. But I think there's also this idea with your background, which I think is really, really interesting. So I'm going to read out some trivia points about you. You're an avid rabbit hunter. You played in a Grateful Dead cover band. I already mentioned that you majored in primitive art at Columbia. So can you sort of give me a sense of, like, what is the connection? How do things like that connect to a lifetime studying how we cook?
Well, it's just a sense of curiosity. Mm-hmm. I think if you delete a good life, I think, I mean, there's lots of answers to that question. I don't know. And I don't have all of them by any means. But I think being curious about things is really the way to go. I was curious about primitive art and ended up working in the Museum of Natural History on Wednesday afternoons while I was going to Columbia. And, you know, I was interested in music and the Grateful Dead and spent a long time chasing them around the country and cooking for them once. You know, I was interested in travel. I've always been interested in travel and in different languages and going around. And I just think the world is infinitely varied and fascinating. Mm-hmm. And so cooking, you know, food is the easiest way, easiest portal into any topic, into any culture, right? I mean, food's a starting point for any discussion. Philosophy, you know, in Japan, how you move in the kitchen is part of the whole philosophy of cooking, right? In Vietnam, it's very Buddhist. You have right intent. You know, you have to have a certain intent when you go into the kitchen, which is important as being a cook. So philosophy, too, is part of cooking. So I think it all goes down to, and driving a taxi in New York while I was at school to raise money for summer, you know, I met a lot of really interesting people, including drug dealers, but, you know, making their pickups and et cetera around the city. But, if you want to learn something about New York, drive a cab, you know, weekends, you know, you learn a lot very quickly. Mm-hmm. So I'm just always interested and, you know, I like to try new stuff. So, you know, it's perfectly suited to food. We're just trying new stuff now.
And a job like driving a cab in New York City, right? How does that, every job shapes us. How does that job shape you?
Well, I did it because I wanted to go to Austria to study German because I was art history major. I needed to speak and read German or read German because a lot of the original materials were in German. And so I decided to drive a cab on the weekends out of a garage on 132nd Street in Broadway to make enough money to go to Austria, which I did, for 6 weeks to study German. It turns out, actually, oddly enough, in the same town where my wife actually grew up in the summers. Mm. So just kind of a strange coincidence. But, it shaped me because and my experience in a farm in Vermont in summers when I was younger, I really appreciate people who do jobs like that. Mm-hmm. It's a hard job. And I got to meet a lot of people who drove cabs. Mm-hmm. And every time I get in a cab now, I'm a huge tipper because I know how hard it is for 8 or 10 or 12 hours to sit in a cab and drive around a city. And so it got me away from the sort of, you know, going to college at Columbia and everything else. It gave me a great appreciation for people who do really hard jobs, you know. And I found out that a lot of those people are really smart, interesting people. You know, if you meet farmers in Vermont or any place, you know, it turns out many of these guys are a lot smarter than you are. Mm-hmm. You know, I would not want to get into a horse trade with the farmers I know in my town because I would end up with a three-legged horse by the time I was finished. I mean, they're smart, you know, and so you find all these gems, these people who are fascinating, interesting, smart people in places you wouldn't normally think, you know, they're not at Columbia, right?
Yeah.
They're driving a cab out of 132nd Street. So that was an important part of growing up for me was that I spent a lot of time with people who were, you know, making $5,000 a year milking cows or driving cabs or whatever. I just really fell in love with what you could find with those people. It's like traveling for food. That 80-year-old making scallion pancakes was really interesting. You know, what an interesting life. And her mother, by the way, is still alive. She's 95 years old. She came down while I was there and just wanted to make sure her daughter was doing it right. You know, it's just the world's really amazing, and you can always find interesting people no matter where you look.
And I think part of the lesson there too is that most people aren't talking to their cabbie, frankly. You know, they're not, and the cabbies aren't necessarily always talking to their fares. And so there's one example among a million of just the interesting thing that's just lying right maybe in front of you sometimes that you're not maybe capturing.
If you want to have an interesting time, always talk to your cabbie, you know, or your, you know, your driver for whatever service you use. But there's always a great story there. And that's, you know, the food world and what we're doing at Mill Street is really about stories, right? It's about where did the recipe come from and who's the person you were talking to and what's their story. And I think food is, you know, I hate the word narrative because everybody uses it now. But, you know, there is a story/narrative around every recipe and every experience when you get a recipe. And that's as interesting as the recipe to me. So tip your cabbie well. And talk to them, because you're going to get great stories.
An ability to hustle and an interest in people and their stories could have taken you any number of places. But at 29, you raised $100,000 from friends and family to start your own magazine. Yep. What interested you in media? Like, why that? Why that path?
Well, I'd always cooked, and so I love cooking. But if you think about, I wouldn't even call it media at the time, it was really magazine publishing. You know, it's one of the last of the old professions, right? I mean, I guess the newspapers really is a lot. But, you know, there's book publishing, there's magazine publishing, newspapers. You know, putting ink on paper and selling it to people is a very old-fashioned concept. Looking more old-fashioned every day, probably. But it's a wonderful thing because it's about ideas, and you put ideas on paper and you sell ideas to people. So that's always appealed to me, is the editorial part of it, which is sitting down every day around a table and arguing about something. And eventually something pops onto a page and goes to a printer and gets sent out through the mail. I mean, it's as 19th century as you can possibly imagine, right? But it's still, you know, if you do it right, it's still a good business, and it's just a very satisfying business. And also, you reach people in a way that's really, it makes you feel good about what you do. I did a book signing last night in Washington, and, you know, a lot of people say they're grateful for the work because you do impact people's lives. You know, becoming a better cook is not a small thing for people. And so, you know, it's an old-fashioned profession that does some good, doesn't change the world, but does some good, and so it's very satisfying.
And the landscape has changed a lot since your first launch, right? So Milk Street is not limited just to a print magazine, right? So there's a podcast, there's a magazine, you've got an online store, you've got events, you know. So with this particular brand, and it's global, this is not about Americana, where maybe people are sort of used to seeing you. You know, what has this particular launch taught you?
Well, it's taught me that we live in a world of brands. We don't live in a world of products anymore. And so Times of Maine isn't really selling toothpaste, right? I mean, they are, but they're selling something greater than that. And I would say that, you know, Starbucks isn't just selling coffee, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so we live in a world where people want to experience, I mean, this is, I'm the 10,000th person to say this, but people want to have an experience with a brand, and a brand has to mean something to them in some way that goes beyond the product itself. So you have to know your brand and what you stand for, and it has to be authentic. I mean, you can't just make it up. You've got to really believe it, because people are smart, and they'll figure out in about 3 seconds whether you're making this up or not. And then everything you do in the brand has to be consistent with that voice. I mean, take Bob Marley, you know. I mean, his 80% of his backlist, it was owned by a guy called Chris Blackwell, who founded Island Records, who is known to Marley from the beginning, you know, was sold for $50 million. to a company that knows how to manage brands. And they didn't buy that just for the songs. They bought it for what Bob Marley stood for. And Bob Marley as a brand was very different than Bob Marley the musician, right? He was true to his roots, and he, you know, he was Rastafarian. He believed in a certain diet. He believed in helping people. He never, you know, lived the high life, really. And he was true to where he came from in Jamaica. And so that was his brand, and it was genuine. And that's why people responded to him so well, other than the music. And so that's the world we live in. So if you want to go into business today, you know, an Apple's a brand, right? It has a certain feeling about it versus Microsoft, right? So that's really the most essential thing if you're going to start a business today, is to figure out what you stand for, who you are, why people want to participate and become part of it. And that's the bedrock starting point. And if you don't know that, then you don't know anything. You really have to understand that. And you have to do something that you actually believe in, because otherwise it's just not going to work out.
Do you think that Milk Street would have worked, since you'd had the idea for Milk Street, would 20 years ago?
No.
Do you don't think it would work?
No.
Why?
No, because, well, because everything has its time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fashion and music industries have done this already, right? They've gone around the world and they've done a mashup of different things. But the food world 20 years ago viewed what I'm doing now as ethnic cooking,
mm-hmm.
a term I don't like very much,
yeah.
Because it was their food and our food, right? And it wasn't everyday food, and it was, you know, big flashy cookbooks, very, you know, lots of ingredients you can't find. Something that takes 8 hours to make. Well, you know, like Indian cookbooks, you know, they weren't really talking about the everyday food, right? They were talking about fancy food. So in the last 20 years, a number of things have happened. You can get ingredients everywhere now. You can go to your local supermarket. And if not, you can get them on Amazon. That was not true when I was starting out. Two, everyone goes to restaurants and everyone knows the difference between real Mexican food and burritos. And so, you know, in real Chinese food versus, you know, what you used to get in the Chinese restaurants I went to back in the 60s, so, which are ersatz, you know, recipes for an American audience. So because people are more familiar with different cuisines, people have access to the ingredients. People can see it in the media, online, YouTube, and Food Network, public television. People are ready to make that jump away from something, a style of cooking that really, for the most part, doesn't make any sense anymore, right? I mean, Northern European cooking from the 19th century, which is Fanny Farmer, mm-hmm. is still what is the basis of American cooking today, really. Mm-hmm. It really hasn't changed that much. And then mastering the art of French cooking, you know, was sort of anomalous. Julia Child came along just to the point where French cooking was kind of dying off in this country, and she resuscitated it. But, you know, that's, for the most part, that's more professional. That's really not what most people want to do now. So we're ready for this. You know, we have the money, at least there's a lot of money around. We can get the ingredients. We're sophisticated about food versus 20 years ago. And there's an appetite, excuse the pun, but there's an appetite to change how we cook. And so this is the moment, not 20 years ago.
And I think all that's true. And I think what's interesting is that a lot of people still would not be able to sort of notice all of those trends and figure out, how do I craft a brand from all of these sort of little different happenings that are overlapping? You know, what do you depend on to sort of craft a brand and craft a way forward in the products that you're creating, in the articles, in the magazine, in the podcast? You know, what are you using? What's your approach?
You're giving me much too much credit. The answer to the question is, I just do what I want to do the way I want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little simplistic, because to do a TV show versus a radio show is a totally different, or a podcast, is obviously a totally different thing. But we always have to go back to what I said earlier, which is your core. And so you have to have a core belief about your brand and what the brand stands for. So if you do television or do radio or do a magazine, do a book, you do a stage event, you do a cooking school, all of those things have to come from the same place. And so it's very easy to do, relatively speaking, if you have the core established. because then you know what works and what doesn't. And then you sort of have to feel your way along. I mean, radio is a good example. I've been doing radio for 7 years now, something like that. You would not want to listen to the first 2 or 3 years of my radio show. Radio, and you do, you know, podcast is difficult, because you have no visuals, obviously. So you have 54 minutes every week to fill, using your voice and other people's voices. And so figuring out how to communicate with people on radio is very tricky, because, you know, we brought in consultants and talked to people, and they always kept saying, you got to find your voice. And I thought that was an idiotic statement because it was obvious, but it actually wasn't. You have to, you know, who are you on radio? Mm-hmm. Well, who you are on radio is the same person on television or in a magazine, but it's different, mm-hmm. because you have to communicate in a different way. Irony, it doesn't work on radio, you know, because people can't see your face. So I could say things on television which people would get. I was just being stupid and funny. But they hear on radio, goes, that's weird. Mm-hmm. Why did he say that? You know. So understanding each medium is a learning process, but you have to do things that make sense for who you are and what the brand is. So that consistency should be there, and without that, you can't do any of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's also a critical thinking component that comes in there, right? That just that question, who am I, right? I don't know that people are always taking the time to ask that question. I think they're looking at what other people are doing, yeah. and how they could do that. Tell me about that question and what happens when you ask yourself that question.
That's a good question. In that, you're absolutely right. We come to work every day here, and my wife is really good at this too. She's the one who chose Milk Street as the name, by the mm-hmm. way. Even though we're on Milk Street, it would seem obvious, but it wasn't. And she loves the fashion world and is really interested in brands and how they manage themselves. We come to office every day asking that question, is this on brand or off brand? Mm-hmm. You know, and two, how can we express the brand better? For example, on social media, you know, everyone throws up their cooking videos, right? If you're in the food world. Well, you know, I think our cooking videos are okay. I don't think they're great. And we haven't made a breakthrough yet in terms of how do we express our brand in the world of social media videos in a way that's distinctive and powerful. Mm-hmm. And so we just had that discussion this morning, you know, about how to do that. And we haven't figured it out yet. Mm-hmm. But we keep going back to it. And it's going to be a slow process of trial and error to sort of get there. But we always ask the question. I think that's right. I don't think you have to be super smart. I think you just have to ask the question all the time. And most people don't. Mm-hmm. Because most people think they're in the product business. They don't understand they're in the brand business. Mm-hmm. I mean, people want an emotional connection to what other people do. Mm-hmm. You know, the world of social media is all about that, right? And so people want to participate in these brands. But you got to really understand the brand to make that work, and it's hard. That's very heavy lifting to figure out how to do that. Mm-hmm. Radio took me years to figure that out, and part of the answer was getting some great contributors to the show, you know, where I could have a different kind of relationship. You know, Dan Pashman of the Sportful Podcast is a regular, just a very funny guy, and so that gives the show a different feel. Or Adam Gopnik from the New Yorker is on it; he's more philosopher, if you will. And he's a little more serious. And so having other people in the conversation with us helps to make the show more interesting. And I think the same thing is true of everything else we do. Television, we have 7 people on the show now, including me, for the next season. And they each have a different personality. And so corralling all of that talent into Milk Street and making them part of Milk Street. You know, in the magazine, we always we go places and talk to people and show them in the magazine. And they're part of Milk Street. So that's also part of the answer, is how you integrate other people into it. But it's hard. But as long as you ask the question every day, you're okay. But if you stop asking it, then I think you're toast in the long run. Because you'll just get left behind. This world, it moves so fast, you know, as everyone knows. You can't afford not to constantly think about who you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know there's no typical day, but what happens to you in a day of running your brand, of running Milk Street? And are you still rolling into work with the bow tie on a motorcycle?
I roll into work at 6:30 a.m. every day.
Mm-hmm.
No, I actually used to ride the motorcycle to work, but I have a 9-month-old son now. I have five children. So I don't think I'll be riding to work on a motorcycle right now. I don't know why. I'm sort of getting nervous about that. I ride in Vermont, but I work in downtown Boston, so
sure.
You know, and Boston drivers are notoriously inept. So, I probably won't do that. But in the day, that's why this is a great job. You know, we'll have a radio meeting about upcoming episodes. We're going to interview. We'll be going through some script discussions for television. We don't really use scripts, but in terms of which recipes we'll be doing, we'll have a discussion about marketing, a discussion about the website, about the store, about live events for the fall, about we're designing a new cookbook, a new cookbook covers, you know, how to do online education, you know, our nonprofit outreach with the kids here in Boston and how we're going to do that. And, you know, so the products, you know, we're developing product lines with other companies and talking to them about new ideas for products. So there's a million different things and tasting food, of course.
Yes.
The nicest part of the job, I get to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a million different things going on.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Milk Street is going to be working with the Girls and Boys Club in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Why is cooking such an important and useful exposure for these kids? Why is it so good?
Well, there's a few reasons, depending on the organization. Like the Big Sisters of Greater Boston is more, you know, career advancement and, you know, maybe giving them a taste of what it might be like to go into this as a career. That would be one. But on a bigger level, I think exposing kids to the cooking process, it's a cooperative thing. They come in, they cook together, and they realize they can actually cook and they eat the food. And it's a gift you give someone. It's a lifetime thing, right? I mean, a lot of these kids aren't coming from households where, you know, they get a chance to be around cooking a lot. And so it gives them an opportunity to pick up something that hopefully they'll keep with them for their life. And might even make a career of it. I mean, I do think that I really believe that cooking is really important. And I think it binds people together and families. And so trying to get kids into the kitchen and get them excited about it. I mean, what could be better? It's just you're doing it one kid at a time. It's not going to change anything nationally, but maybe someday we can hopefully put together a curriculum that would work, you know, for the Girl Scouts or someone across the country. And then, you know, home ec's been given up and it's time to put it back in a new way.
There's a line in your November-December issue, and it says, the lesson for modern cooks is adaptability and a keen eye for culinary advantage. That's from your column. And what I think is really interesting about that is that the kitchen, in a lot of ways, teaches us how to cope, right? Something doesn't work.
Yeah.
Something gets burned. Something, you know, I have to start again or whatever. I have to adapt, right? So many people don't cook, and they're not in these situations where they need to cope in maybe a little everyday sort of rudimentary way. How important are these little reminders that we can adapt, it's okay, this messed up, but I can fix it? How important are these little moments, and how does cooking help us with that?
Well, that philosophy comes from my time in Vermont. Growing up, when I watch Vermonters fix things I didn't think could be fixed. I remember spending one afternoon replacing a clutch in a 1949 Farmall tractor, and I was a kid, and I was the only one who could get under the tractor easily.
Yeah.
So I had to take off the pressure plate and the clutch. And I had no idea what I was doing, but it took like 4 or 5 hours that we got the job done. And I've seen people fix things with, you know, pliers and a hammer and some baling twine, you know, or fix an internal combustion engine by going through all the steps you go through to fix a chainsaw, lawnmower, or whatever tractor. And they always get it done. They don't give up, and they're very logical about the steps they have to take to figure it out. And I think that's a good lesson, because in modern life, most people, you know, they have a leaky faucet and they look at it and do something that doesn't work and they just give up and call the plumber. But in a grander way, I think the lesson's obvious, which is that, you know, if you just stick to it, you'll eventually sort it out. But that stubbornness, and I think it's also about self-reliance, right? I mean, it's having the confidence to know that you will get it done. In the Vermonter's case, there is no choice. You know, someone else isn't going to fix it for you, and you got a whole hayfield, you got to mow and bale, so you got to get that tractor fixed. But you know, I think most of us today, we just don't have the stick-to-itiveness most people used to have, and so we give up. And you know, that's a good lesson, I think, is not to give up.
Sure. Your team, do you have a meal that you share together, either once a week or any kind of regular interval?
At the office?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, no, we're sharing 10 meals a day, so I don't know. I mean, the secret about, you know, is the people who cook here. We have mm-hmm. like 5 people who cook sure. here. I don't think they ever cook dinner during the week because they've eaten all day, or they could take the food home. The last thing they're going to do is go home and spend 2 hours cooking. They do on the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But I do cook when I go home because mm-hmm. I try to learn how to taste, which means I don't take a whole bowl full. I do occasionally, but try to take a small amount. But we do, it would be nice actually to have a staff meal, you mean, like they do in restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
That would actually be a nice thing to do. Probably we should do it.
But even these little moments where maybe you're testing something or you're running through something, you know, they're still bringing people together and you're still sharing something. How do you think that maybe changes things for your team, you know, compared to like a typical office where maybe the only time maybe somebody sees somebody else is that 5 seconds when you're pouring out a coffee and you run back
yeah.
to your desk, you know, like how do those, that those sharing moments sort of bolster the team?
It does. Well, first of all, the construct of the office is 8,000 square feet, and there are very few offices.
Yeah.
And there's a huge central area, which is the kitchen. There's the back kitchen. There's the front kitchen, which is also the cooking school and television show
mm-hmm.
area. And then there's another long area, which is a big, long table with chairs. And so people often, instead of working at a cubicle, will come down and work out sort of in the common area. And then people stand around all the time around the main cooktop, which is oval. And, you know, food comes out every half hour and people stand around tasting and talking. And it gives a central familial feel to the office. It has a center. It's like, a kitchen's the center of the house. Well, the kitchen's the center of our office. So it's not really an office. People spend a lot of time in the common areas. And yeah, I think, I mean, you know, sometimes it's annoying if I say, I don't really like that, or you know, that's really boring, or why did you put that in it? But we've finally figured out how to say those things kindly and supportively. You know, and then we're recording radio here or recording video at least once a week. A video crew comes in and we do videos. And there's always something going on. So there's photography once or twice a week. We have our photographer here, you know, taking pictures for the magazine and the book. So, yeah, it completely changed the feel of the office.
For people who are interested in maybe tapping into their own, making the most of their curiosity, finding ways to narrow into, like, who they really are, what do you recommend they do? What should they be thinking about? What should they be doing? What should they be exploring? How can they create some kind of a framework to do what they didn't know they should be doing?
Well, two things. Most people are risk averse. So if you're starting out in life, you know, you really don't want to be in a position where you can't take a risk. And so you can't be strapped by, if possible, you know, a lot of financial obligation and everything else. I mean, it's better to be in a position where you can take a chance, move around and try different things. Taking a risk on your own is not riskier than working for a big company.
Mm-hmm.
Because working at a big company is full of risk. All
yeah.
sorts of things can happen to you. And so going out on your own and trying stuff is great and sticking to it. My oldest daughter is 29, and she, you know, is a writer, and she wrote for Jezebel, and she's now at Harper's Weekly, actually. But she spent 10 years, and I offered to introduce her to people, and she said, no, I'm going to do it on my own. Mm-hmm. And she did horrible jobs and lived in Bed-Stuy, you know,
yeah.
In Brooklyn in terrible apartments and really, really had a rough time. And finally she's making it now because she stuck to it.
Mm-hmm.
And she was willing to do it. So I think that's it. The other thing is, you know, there's no point in doing something unless you really love it. And I know that's a luxury for people. Most
yeah.
people don't get to do what they love. But boy, if you find something you really love to do, even though you may not get rich doing it, you're going to be 10 times happier, and you're also going to be more successful because you really love it. So it's always that first step, right? I find people get married, you know, so sometimes they don't think that through. Sometimes in careers, they just take the first job and they kind of end up sticking with it. Mm-hmm. Or if you're starting a business, it's that first 10 minutes that's most important, right? Yeah. It's the basic concept. You've got to spend a lot of time on that. So I would, in your 20s, spend as much time as you can doing different things. Don't get bogged down by you have to do this to make money, if possible, and then take the risk. Now, I always felt if I started my company at 29, I always say, what's the worst that could happen? You know, the worst that could happen is, I take $100,000, lose it, and I go get a job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I have deep responsibility to my investors, but, better than you're at my age, which is well past 29. In the last years, I've had to start all over, essentially, and raise a lot more than $100,000. But, I'm taking the same risk I took at 29, except I have 5 kids and, lots of other obligations. And it's a much bigger risk. But you know what? I have the same answer. What's the worst that could happen?
Yeah.
And some way or another, you always find a way, mm-hmm. you always find a way forward. So people don't like risk, but I think risk is really the answer, right?
Well, this has been really great, Chris. Thank you so much for all this. I think our listeners will really appreciate all of these insights.
And before we go, some short announcements for our listeners. How Success Happens comes out weekly. To make sure you don't miss a single episode, subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and SoundCloud, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And don't be afraid to leave us a review. It helps us improve and reach more listeners just like you. And for more stories like this one on the mindset you need to start and grow a business, go to entrepreneur.com. To let me know what you think about the show, find me on Twitter at Linda Lacina. That's the @ LINDALACINA. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.